I'm Alex Sagan, and welcome to The Deep Dive.
And I'm Sam Fleming.
We are really getting into it this week with a massive stack of new scientific articles. And we're here to give you that shortcut to, well, to being completely up to speed on everything from the cosmos to, believe it or not, the secret life of your own body fat. Our mission is to pull out the key findings, the really surprising facts that make you rethink what you know. And we're starting right now. This is our deep dive titled Live Science for the Week of November 22nd, 2025.
And this collection of research is, it's pretty exceptional. It forces you to fundamentally reevaluate things you thought were settled.
Right.
We're talking about the geometry of the universe, what causes autoimmune disease, and yeah, even the most basic components of our own bodies. We've pulled together the core insights from, well, from just about every discipline you can imagine.
And we're going to start with something that on the surface seems almost mundane, but the science behind it is maybe one of the most radical shifts in modern medicine. We're talking about body fat. For generations, fat's been treated as this inert baggage, right? Something that just sits there padding our organs, or, you know, worse, something we're supposed to hate.
And all that derogatory language, you know, muffin top, jelly belly, it all reflects this historical kind of moralizing view that treats adipose tissue as like a passive nuisance or some kind of personal failure.
Exactly.
But the sources are crystal clear on this.
Yeah.
We have to throw that view out. It's time for a total redefinition, seeing fat not as simple storage, but as a vital, highly dynamic organ in its own right.
An organ. That's the core takeaway here. Fat is a crucial body system that's in constant conversation with the brain, with the bones, the liver, and critically, the immune system. So when did we first figure out we were so spectacularly wrong about this?
Well, the first really big clue that we were underestimating it all came back in the 1990s.
Okay.
That was with the discovery of leptin. Leptin is a hormone that's secreted by the fat cells themselves. It travels through your blood, acts on the brain, and it regulates appetite and how much energy you burn.
So it's basically telling the brain how much energy reserve the body has.
Precisely. And this is why crash diets often fail.
Mm-hmm.
When you lose weight really fast, your leptin levels plummet. That signals starvation to the brain, which then just cranks up the hunger signals. It's a survival mechanism.
And it's not just a slow chemical message. The sources detail a much more complex, much faster network.
Oh, absolutely. Neuroscientists like Christy Townsend have shown just overwhelming evidence for these complex networks of fine nerve fibers that extend deep into the fat tissue.
Wow.
It creates this fast, bidirectional communication highway straight to the brain. So fat isn't just a sponge soaking up calories. It's a sophisticated sensor, instantly relaying information about its own health, you know, whether it's injured or inflamed or stressed.
Well, the immune system is right in the middle of that conversation, using fat as a kind of relay station.
That's a perfect way to put it. The tissue that surrounds the fat cells, the adipocytes, it's just packed with immune cells, macrophages, T cells, you name it. This makes fat a proper immune organ. It actively manages inflammation. And it sends out distress signals using these chemical messengers called adipokines.
Mm.
And, you know, without enough fat, you run into really serious problems. Hormonal issues, infertility, trouble fighting infections. The immune system is compromised. Its role is so much more vital than just storage or insulation.
What's incredible to me is that this tissue we thought was just one thing actually has multiple distinct types. It's almost like a rainbow of different functions.
This really is. About 95% of our energy stores are what we call white fat. These are big cells, each with a single large droplet of lipid. That's your main energy depot, your insulation, your cushioning.
Okay, standard stuff.
Then you have brown fat, which is, from an evolutionary standpoint, fascinating.
Hmm.
It's tucked away in small deposits, mostly on the shoulders and neck, and it's packed with mitochondria, which gives it that darker color.
And that's the good fat we hear about.
Right, because its job is thermogenesis. It burns fatty acids just to generate heat. That's what helped our ancestors survive the cold. It's basically a biological furnace.
And then there are the even less common types, beige and pink, which show just how adaptable fat really is.
Yeah, beige fat is sprinkled within the white fat areas.
Hmm.
It's super flexible. It can actually take on the energy burning characteristics of brown fat when you exercise or get exposed to cold. And then pink fat appears in the breasts during pregnancy and lactation. It literally transforms from white fat cells to support milk production.
So it's this whole integrated system.
It is. One researcher, Saverio Sinti, argues these parts are so interconnected, balancing storage, heat, hormones, that they really do form a single integrated adipose organ.
So if we accept that fat is a vital organ, How does that change how we should be thinking about obesity?
It fundamentally rewrites the clinical definition. The sources really push back against seeing obesity as a moral failure.
Right.
They propose we should see it as organ failure, malfunctioning fat cells. If the fat cells get overwhelmed, if they're starved of blood or they're pumping out too many inflammatory signals, then the organ has failed to keep you metabolically healthy.
That is a huge conceptual shift because it changes the goal, doesn't it? The goal isn't just to hit some arbitrary number on a scale anymore.
Exactly.
It's about reprogramming the fat's function to get it healthy again.
Precisely. And this framework helps explain why the new generation of GLP-1 drugs, like Wegovy and Ozempic, are so effective.
Mm-hmm.
The benefits seem to come just as much from improving how fat is distributed and how it functions, kind of coaxing the organ back into working properly, as they do from just the weight loss itself.
Mm.
If you can restore the health of the fat organ, patients get their metabolic flexibility back, no matter what their final size is.
But it's the location of the fat that really dictates the risk, isn't it? There's a big difference between the fat under your skin and the fat deep inside.
That distinction is absolutely critical. It's the visceral fat. The fat that wraps around your internal organs like the liver and intestines, that's the real toxic offender.
And why is that?
When the fat cells, the adipocytes, in that area get overloaded and too big, their blood supply just can't keep up. They get stressed, they start to die. And the dying cells release this flood of inflammatory molecules that act like distress signals, causing system-wide inflammation.
And then inflammation then kicks off a whole cascade of other metabolic problems.
It does. Those chemical signals directly interfere with insulin receptors, which rapidly increases the risk for type 2 diabetes. They contribute to the cognitive issues linked with obesity. They raise the risk for certain cancers. And on top of that, the dying fat cells release all these excess fatty acids. That leads to something called lipotoxic stress.
Lipotoxic stress.
Yeah, and this stress physically damages the fragile network of nerves that are threaded all through the fat tissue. That condition is now being recognized as adipose neuropathy.
So you get nerve damage inside your fat.
Exactly. And that nerve damage disrupts metabolism even further. It just creates this vicious cycle of dysfunction.
So the location is key. But there's this huge anomaly in the research, right? Metabolically healthy obesity, MHO. How is it that 10 to 30% of people who are classified as obese don't get these typical health problems?
MHO is where this idea of organ failure gets really nuanced. These individuals, by BMI, are obese, but their fat cells are fundamentally healthier.
Oh.
They have greater metabolic flexibility. They can switch between storing and burning energy really efficiently. And crucially, their fat cells are often smaller, and they produce far fewer of those inflammatory signals. And even within the visceral area, the exact location seems to matter. The highest risk are linked to fat that sits outside the intestine, which suggests that how close it is to certain organs influences how toxic it becomes.
And if that fat organ has malfunctioned in the past, it seems to hold a grudge. That could explain the incredibly frustrating yo-yo effect of dieting.
This idea of fat memory is so important. Researchers have found that even after someone loses weight, these chemical markers, epigenetic markers, are left behind on the fat cells.
Like a scar, sort of. In studies on mice, these markers stayed there, essentially priming the fat cells. When the mice were put back on a high-fat diet, these prime cells stored fat way faster than the control group.
Wow.
This epigenetic memory suggests that the longer you're obese, the more embedded this memory becomes, which makes keeping weight off a profound biological challenge, not just a behavioral one.
So if we could find a way to chemically erase those marks, we might be able to stop weight regain entirely.
Yeah.
Though the researchers are still looking into whether that memory is just in the fat or if the brain also holds on to a memory of that weight. It's a whole system.
It is a whole system, which is why just, you know, mechanical interventions often don't work. One researcher pointed out that in studies on liposuction, if you just suck out the subcutaneous fat, the body often compensates, it stores that energy somewhere else, and it frequently comes back as the much more dangerous visceral fat. You have to understand the organ's function, that complexity. It's a profound way to think about chronic health, and it's a great segue. Let's move from this internal organ function to other key biological processes, like healing and immunity. And there's a huge breakthrough here regarding lupus.
This is massive. We now have the strongest evidence yet that links the common Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, the one that causes mono or glandular fever, to the development of lupus.
Right. And historically, that link has always been a bit shaky because EBV infects something like 95% of all adults, but only a tiny fraction of them ever get lupus.
Exactly. The question was always why. So what was the mechanism? What did they find this time?
What was the smoking gun?
researchers used this highly specialized single-cell RNA sequencing platform, they called it EBV Sector, zoom in on specific immune cells in lupus patients. And what they found was that about 25 of every 10,000 B cells they sequenced in lupus patients were actively infected with EBV.
Compared to what in healthy people?
Compared to almost zero in the healthy control groups. And crucially, most of these infected cells were memory B cells. That means the virus was targeting the long-term archive of the immune system.
So the virus wasn't just hiding out, it was actively using the immune cells to sabotage the body.
That's it. The virus produces a protein called EBNA2. And this protein binds directly to two specific human genes, ZEB2 and TBX21, and it basically cranks up their activity. This sets off a cascade that hyperactivates helper T cells, which triggers the aggressive, misdirected immune attack that defines lupus, the body attacking its own healthy tissue.
This has huge implications, not just for lupus.
Oh, absolutely. It gives massive support to the push to develop an EBV vaccine. Now, a vaccine wouldn't cure people who are already infected, but preventing that initial infection in kids and teenagers could potentially head off not just lupus, but other autoimmune conditions like multiple sclerosis, which was also definitively linked to EBV back in 2022.
It also helps explain why some of these new CAR T cell therapies are showing such success in early lupus trials.
Right. The theory is that by depleting the B cells, these therapies are clearing out the specific EBV-infected B cells that are driving the whole problem.
From viruses, let's look at how our own genetics can affect something as basic as wound healing. And it turns out, your hair color might actually play a part.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
It all comes down to the MC1R gene, which is the variant responsible for red hair. Almost all red-haired people have an inactive form of the MC1R protein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gene is best known for pigment, obviously. But the protein is also in our skin, where it has these really important anti-inflammatory functions that are critical for healing quickly.
And the study on mice confirmed a pretty significant delay in healing for the ones with that inactive protein.
It did, yeah. In the red-haired mice, wounds had only shrunk by 73% after a week. That's a stark contrast to the 93% shrinkage they saw in the black hair control mice. The impaired anti-inflammatory response was the clear culprit. And this is more than just a fun fact. The researchers found that topical drugs designed to boost MC1R activity actually sped up healing significantly in the black-haired mice. This could pave the way for a whole new class of treatments to help people who are genetically deficient in this protein.
That is fascinating. And, you know, speaking of nuance in healing, it's not purely a biological process. It's also highly social. We've got evidence that emotional connection, physical touch, can actually accelerate recovery.
The famous love hormone effect. Researchers studied 80 healthy couples who were given small, standardized wounds. They combined a twice-daily oxytocin nasal spray with something they called a partner appreciation task, or PEAT.
And what was that?
It's where the couples would take time to express deep gratitude for each other. And they found the fastest healing happened in the couples who used the oxytocin, did the PAT, and reported engaging in close physical contact or sexual activity.
So it wasn't enough to just have the hormone or just the gratitude. You needed that synergy of physical and emotional intimacy.
It's a direct clinical link between the neurochemistry of bonding and physical recovery. It suggests that psychological safety and physical closeness are essential ingredients for the body's own repair systems.
That's a really powerful idea. And it leads us nicely into a discussion of more severe physical recovery, specifically a revolutionary non-invasive treatment for brain trauma. We're talking about using ultrasound to treat hemorrhagic stroke bleeding in the brain, which is often just disastrous.
And the current treatments are pretty invasive. They involve catheters to drain the dead cells and blood, which can often cause more damage. But this Stanford team, led by Raag Iran, they trialed this really promising non-invasive technique using pulsed ultrasound.
Okay, so how did they apply it, and what were the results?
They applied the ultrasound to the outside of the heads of mice that had a stroke mimic. It was just for 10 minutes a day over 3 days. The results were astounding. Survival rates went up by about 30 percentage points compared to the control group, and the overall brain damage was drastically reduced.
And the mechanism here is highly targeted, right? It's not just scrambling the tissue.
Not at all. The ultrasound waves specifically activate these pressure-sensitive proteins that are found on microglia, the brain's resident immune cells.
Mm-hmm.
By activating those proteins, the ultrasound basically boosts the microglia's ability to efficiently clear away all the inflammatory dead red blood cells that build up after the bleed. It's literally powering up the brain's cleanup crew. This is a massive leap forward.
That's profound. And it shows how these subtle physical inputs can have life-saving biological outputs. Now, if we know that close physical contact and oxytocin are key for individual healing, you have to wonder what happens when a generation starts swapping that kind of intimacy for screens. And that's a natural bridge to look at some broader cultural trends, starting with what's being called a quiet emergency, the global decline in sexual activity among young people.
This is a sociological shift that is it's undeniable, especially in high-income nations. And the data is pretty striking. In the U.S., sexual inactivity among 18 to 29-year-olds actually doubled. It went from 12% in 2010 to 24% in 2024.
Doubled in about a decade.
Mm.
And in a place like Japan, it's seen as a full-blown crisis, right? Mm. It's linked to their record low birth rates, with nearly half of people sexually inexperienced through their mid-20s.
It's a huge demographic issue there.
So what are the key drivers? What's converging to cause this?
The sources point to four big overlapping causes. The first, and maybe the biggest, is economic instability and housing access.
Right.
The tough financial climate, student debt, youth unemployment, it all means less independence. And crucially, the proportion of 25 to 34-year-olds in the U.S. living with their parents has just surged from 9% in 2000 to 18% in 2023.
And as the researchers say, sharing your childhood bedroom with your parents down the hall is not exactly conducive to starting a sexual relationship.
Not at all. And this trend is especially pronounced among young men with lower income and unstable jobs.
So a lack of private, affordable space is a huge practical barrier. What about the cultural habits?
The second factor is the rise of Generation Sensible. We're seeing increasing sobriety. The percentage of 18 to 34-year-olds in the U.S. who drank has dropped from 72% to 62% in two decades.
And while that's great for health.
Right. It has clear health benefits, but alcohol often acts as a social lubricant. It reduces the inhibitions that can help people navigate the, you know, the awkwardness of new physical encounters.
And the third factor is the digital deluge, a generation that's the most connected and paradoxically the loneliest.
Precisely. Gen Z has swapped a lot of in-person socializing for screens. This is leading to more anxiety about physical interaction and real difficulty in translating a digital connection into real-world intimacy.
And the tools that are supposed to help? The dating apps.
They often make it worse. They're designed to hook users to the platform with addictive features to generate revenue, not to efficiently help you find a meaningful encounter. A lot of young people report logging off these apps because of the depression and anxiety that comes with that constant low-level rejection.
And finally, there's a cultural shift that's actually positive, reducing some of the pressure.
Yes. There's much less stigma around identifying as asexual or just choosing not to have sex. And also, increased awareness about consent, partly from movements like hashtag MeToo, has arguably made young people more cautious, which removes that old cultural expectation that sex was some kind of mandatory rite of passage.
But the implication is debated, right? I mean, should we be worried about this decline?
Some researchers are definitely worried that if this decline means people are having a harder time living the rich, intimate lives they actually want, then it's a quality of life issue. Mm-hmm. But others argue it's not a real emergency if people are content with their choices. The consensus seems to be that governments shouldn't be targeting sexual activity directly. If they're concerned, they should focus on the underlying issues. Housing, the cost of living, this pandemic of alienation, you know, fix the root cause and the symptom will likely take care of itself.
Addressing a different major challenge that affects up to 80% of women, let's move to menopause and specifically treating hot flushes with a surprisingly low-tech and accessible tool, home hypnosis.
Yeah, hot flushes are caused by that dramatic drop in estrogen. And while we have treatments like HRT or CBT, they don't work for everyone. And some women can't take HRT at all. So this new approach is a really convenient alternative.
It was a simple 6-week home program.
That's right. Participants listened to these 20-minute hypnotic audio recordings every day. They were designed to induce deep relaxation while focusing on imagery of coolness, like standing under a waterfall or feeling a cool breeze.
And the results were pretty convincing.
Very convincing. At 6 weeks, the hypnosis group reported that the frequency and severity of their hot flushes were down by 53%. And that benefit actually got better, improving to 61% at the 12-week follow-up.
What's really interesting here is the mechanism. It supports the idea that the brain is actually modifying its own connections.
Right. Hypnosis has been shown to be effective for things like pain and anxiety for a long time. And this just reinforces the idea that it lets the brain actively rewire itself. By By going into that highly receptive state, the brain seems to recalibrate its own internal thermostat, which is what goes haywire from the hormone changes. It's low cost, convenient, and highly effective.
A really practical solution. Now, let's pivot sharply to a historical controversy that brings us to the very dangerous intersection of media sensationalism and genetics, the analysis of Adolf Hitler's DNA.
This refers to that highly criticized UK Channel 4 project that sequenced DNA from a piece of bloodstained fabric. The Y chromosome analysis did confirm that Hitler didn't have a Jewish grandfather, which debunked an old rumor.
But the controversy wasn't about the historical fact-checking. It was about the dangerous idea of genetic determinism, which was right there in the documentary's title, Blueprint of a Dictator.
The title is the fundamental problem. It sensationalizes this idea that monstrous behavior is just fixed by a person's DNA. And that goes against everything we know about human behavior. We know from twin studies that identical twins who share 100% of their DNA can have vastly different lives. Even for something like criminality, the highest estimates for how much is heritable are less than 50%. So the idea that Hitler's DNA holds a blueprint for being a dictator is just baseless.
The documentary also claimed Hitler scored highly on what are called polygenic scores for complex conditions like autism, schizophrenia, and psychopathy. And that's where the technical flaws meet the ethical ones.
This is pure speculation, and it's highly irresponsible. Polygenic scores estimate your risk for complex conditions based on thousands of genetic markers, but they're so far from being diagnostic, especially for traits that are heavily influenced by your environment.
Right.
We can't even predict simple things like eye color with perfect accuracy, let alone something as complex as psychopathy. So using a high score for schizophrenia, for instance, to imply causation in a historical figure is just deeply misleading, and it unfairly increases the stigma around mental health conditions.
And the real story, as the sources emphasize, is far more likely in the historical and personal context.
Absolutely. The neglect, the abuse from his alcoholic father, the political instability of the time, those things are infinitely more relevant to understanding his psychology and his rise to power than a few genetic markers.
And focusing on the DNA also risks painting Hitler as this uniquely biologically evil figure, which diverts attention from the broader societal responsibility.
We have to remember that millions of people voted for him. Millions of others implemented the laws that enabled the Holocaust. The real historical question isn't why certain people seek to become dictators, but why society allows it to happen. Analyzing the DNA is a neat but deeply flawed distraction from that collective responsibility.
That is a crucial reminder. Okay, let's move from that difficult history into deep time and the incredible secrets that are emerging from the Siberian permafrost.
We are talking about the retrieval of the world's oldest known RNA, 40,000 years old, from the muscle and skin of the woolly mammoth Yucca. That just triples the previous record.
This is a monumental technical achievement. RNA is notoriously unstable. It usually degrades within hours of death. So how on earth did 40,000-year-old RNA survive?
Yucca's preservation was just exceptional. It was due to rapid freezing and then long-term burial in that pristine permafrost. And this is so important because while DNA is the blueprint of an organism, RNA, specifically messenger RNA, shows you which genes were actively switched on at the moment of death. It's a biological snapshot.
So what did that snapshot reveal about Yucca's final moments?
The RNA sequencing showed a really high level of gene activity related to muscle metabolism and cell stress. And that data is perfectly consistent with the leading hypothesis that Yucca died under extreme duress, most likely during a cave lion attack. And as a bonus, the combined DNA and RNA analysis settled an old debate. Yucca, who was previously thought to be a juvenile female, was definitively determined to be male.
The sources say this RNA isn't really the key to de-extinction, but what are the implications for paleontology?
Well, it proves that these highly fragile biomolecules can survive for far longer than we ever thought possible. And that opens up a whole new window into the biology of ancient life. For example, these RNA profiles could tell us exactly which genes controlled traits like the mammoth's dense hair, giving us functional insights that DNA alone can't provide. It sets the stage for future studies on, say, Ice Age RNA viruses or other rare, well-preserved specimens.
That's a perfect transition from ancient biological traces to ancient human culture and this field of archaeoacoustics, the radical idea that prehistoric rock art was meant to be heard as much as it was seen.
This completely reframes how we should be looking at these prehistoric caves. The idea is that ancient artists, maybe 40,000 years ago, chose specific spots because the cave itself would sing back to them. The art was placed deliberately in areas with unusual acoustic phenomena.
This field had a bit of a struggle for legitimacy at first, didn't it? Based on some early kind of subjective experiments.
It did. It started with a musicologist, Igor Reznikov, who would literally walk into caves and sing and then follow the resonance to find where the paintings were.
Huh.
But the science got much more rigorous with people like Steve Waller. He found that in deep caves in France, the painted walls produced these distinct echoes, sometimes up to 31 decibels louder. And these echoes would blur together, often simulating the sound of a stampede of hoofed animals.
Which is what they were painting on the walls.
Exactly. Hoofed animals account for over 90% of European rock art. The echo was seen as a sign of the presence of spirits or thunder gods.
And the 7-year Global Art Soundscapes project brought in modern tech to provide the definitive proof.
Yeah, they moved way beyond just listening for echoes. They used dodecahedron speakers for omnidirectional sound, impulse response measurement, to get a room sonic fingerprint, GIS modeling. And the conclusion was statistically robust. There's a clear, deliberate link between where they put the rock art and where there were unusual acoustics.
Let's get into some of the global examples, because the intention behind the sound seems to vary from place to place.
Right. In Spain's Valtorta Gorge, the sound properties would change dramatically, either amplifying or shifting the moment you reach the painted areas. It's clear evidence of deliberate site selection.
Hmm.
In another site in Spain, Sierra de San Servan, the art was in rock shelters that offered augmented audibility. These were locations that allowed for acoustic control over the whole landscape, perfect for clear communication over long distances.
So some sites were for deep ritual reverberation, and others were basically ancient auditoriums.
Exactly. In Nevada's White River Narrows, the sites chosen for art were selected for exceptional sound transmission and clarity. That suggests they were used for storytelling or gatherings, where every word needed to be heard clearly, not for echo-heavy rituals.
And conversely, in Siberia's Altai Mountains, it seems to lean back towards ritual.
For sure. Researchers there found high clarity and amplification at spots that were likely gathering places, consistent with music and chanting. But maybe the most unnerving finding was in Finland.
Okay.
Prehistoric hunter-gatherers left their marks on these cliffs that produced a highly disorienting sonic reflection, what the researchers called a doubled reality.
What does that mean?
Modern listeners who were part of the research reported perceiving a clear presence or a human-like source coming from behind the art. It often left them feeling quite scared or disoriented.
Wait, so prehistoric people were using audio cues to literally induce altered states of consciousness. That's next-level sound design.
It's a profound manipulation of physical acoustics for ritual. The 35,000-year-old bone flutes they found in Istaritz Cave, when replicas were played in those caverns, went from being this polite little tone to an enormous soaring sound that just filled the entire space.
And the 5,000-year-old tomb in Malta, Jel Ceflini, is the ultimate example of architecture built as a musical instrument.
That hypogeum is incredible. One specific chamber, the oratory room, was engineered to sustain bass frequencies for 35 seconds when a drum was played. Neuroscientists later found that the specific 110 hertz frequency, like a low baritone voice, tended to deactivate the brain's language centers while boosting emotional processing.
So ritual chanting in that specific space was designed to alter consciousness.
It strongly supports that idea, yeah. To create a powerful shared experience, yeah. Maybe induce trance-like states.
This shift in understanding has major implications for how we conserve these sites.
Waller emphasizes this. We have to preserve the entire soundscape. If you build a modern visitor center or even a restroom without thinking about the acoustics, you can unintentionally ruin the very sonic phenomenon that made the site sacred in the first place.
Speaking of ancient attempts to interpret the world, let's look at what might be the oldest known depiction of cosmic creation.
This involves a 4,300-year-old silver goblet, the Ain Samia goblet, found in a tomb in the Palestinian West Bank. A team led by Eberhard Zanger argues that the artwork etched into this little artifact illustrates a creation story that's about 1,000 years older than the famous Babylonian Enuma Elia.
And the narrative is clearly split into two scenes, right? Chaos giving way to order.
That's right. Scene one is primordial chaos. You have a monster serpent rearing up against a weak chimera, a god fused with animal parts, while a small, powerless-looking sun, shown as a little flower-like circle, is placed low in the goblet. Then in scene two, you have the emergence of order. Powerful humanoid figures are holding a much larger, smiling, potent-looking sun aloft in what looks like a celestial boat, and the defeated serpent is shown below them.
Which they interpret as the separation of the heavens and the earth.
Yes, it's a visual story of the cosmos going from chaos to order, an idea that's supported by cuneiform texts from the same period. Now, not all researchers agree. Some think it's just a picture of the sun's daily journey. But it provides this extremely rare and powerful visual of what these ancient people believed creation actually looked like.
From the deep past, let's rocket forward to the extreme edge of physics and material science. The impossible geometry of quasicrystals.
Quasicrystals are just fascinating because they defied the fundamental rules of 19th century math. They have what are called forbidden symmetries, like five-fold rotational symmetry, which were thought to be absolutely impossible in a repeating crystal structure.
Right, because traditional crystals, like salt or a diamond, are made of atomic patterns that tile together perfectly, like squares on a floor. A pentagon, a five-sided shape, can't tile a flat plane without leaving gaps.
Exactly. But in 1983, theorists like Steinhardt and Levine proposed this new form of solid quasicrystals. Their atomic patterns never repeat exactly, which allows for these mathematically forbidden shapes. A year later, Daniel Shechtman found one in a lab-grown alloy, and he eventually won the Nobel Prize for it.
But for decades, everyone just assumed these were unstable, unnatural things you could only make in a lab.
That was the assumption. But Steinhardt and a geologist named Luca Bindi proved it was wrong. They found the first natural quasicrystal in a tiny grain inside a meteorite called Kadikite from Russia.
Wow.
That was the definitive proof that these complex structures are not only possible in nature, but they can survive for millions of years and the rigors of space travel. It completely changed the landscape of material science.
And the most surprising discovery is where they form, in total chaos and violent high-energy shocks.
Yeah, they found the quasicrystals form readily in the most extreme environments. They found them in trinitite, the radioactive green glass that was formed by the heat of the very first atomic bomb test, Trinity.
Unbelievable.
And they also found them in fulgurite, or fossilized lightning, which was formed when a lightning bolt hit sand in a power line out in Nebraska.
So an explosion, a cosmic impact, an electric discharge, they're born from chaos. What's the implication of that?
It means quasicrystals can be used as these unique durable markers to read the history of violent shocks. They can help us understand cosmic impacts during the formation of planets. They can tell us about meteor-battered worlds like Mars and the Moon, where they're now likely to be pretty common. It opens up entirely new ways to analyze planetary history.
That's an exciting new tool. Okay, shifting our focus to some other cosmic mysteries, we have two quick, intriguing astrophysics tidbits. First, this incredibly lonely galaxy, NGC 67789.
This galaxy is isolated in what's known as the local void. It's an area of space that's almost completely empty of gas and other galaxies. And yet, in the last 600 million years, it has formed about 100 million suns worth of stars.
Which makes no sense.
It's a profound mystery. Galaxies need a constant supply of cold, dense gas to fuel star formation, and NGC 6789 just shouldn't have any fuel left.
So astronomers did some deep imaging, hoping to find, what, merger debris or some sign of where the gas came from?
That was the hope. They were looking for evidence that it merged with a smaller gas-rich neighbor, or maybe that huge dark molecular clouds had been funneled in somehow. Mm. But the deep imaging showed absolutely nothing. The source of its star fuel is a complete mystery. It continues to defy gravitational logic.
Our second tidbit confirms a catastrophic process on a distant star. We have definitive proof of a massive coronal mass ejection, or CME.
CMEs are these huge bubbles of magnetized plasma that get thrown out during stellar storms. On our own sun, they cause geomagnetic storms and auroras, but on other stars, they're crucial for modeling whether an exoplanet could be habitable.
Because a direct hit could strip away a planet's atmosphere.
Over time, yes. Astronomers had seen hints of stellar storms elsewhere, but never the definitive proof that the material actually escaped the star's magnetic field.
But that changed with the LOFAR radio telescope.
The telescope detected a distinct burst of radio waves that was emitted by the CME as it traveled through space. This confirmed it had completely detached from the star STKM-1262, which is 130 light years away. This is the smoking gun. It confirms that the violent stellar weather we see on our sun is common elsewhere, which is vital information for assessing whether exoplanets can support life.
From the catastrophic cosmos, let's turn to the future of computing, where IBM is making some really significant strides in quantum technology.
IBM's whole strategy for functional quantum computing is really focused on increasing the connectivity between the qubits. They see that as the key to overcoming errors and instability. And they just unveiled two new quantum computers, Nighthawk and Loon.
And Loon is the really innovative design, right?
Yes. Loon has this unprecedented level of connectivity. Each qubit is connected to six others, and it has the ability to break the plane to move connections vertically through the chip. Nighthawk is still a workhorse, connecting each qubit to four others.
And this increased connectivity translates directly to how complex the calculations can be.
Absolutely. The early tests show Nighthawk can run programs that are 30% more complex than previous models. And this high connectivity is vital for their strategy of creating error-free logical qubits. They're pioneering a method that lets these logical qubits be physically smaller, which sidesteps that huge challenge of needing millions of physical qubits. But it all relies on having this robust, highly connected architecture to maintain coherence.
And on a completely different track, we have the mind-boggling concept of chemical computing, which mimics an adaptive biological system.
This is a form of non-digital computing. Researchers built a physical computer using a network of seven different types of enzymes that were loaded onto tiny hydrogel beads. And then short amino acid chains, peptides, act as the software or the data input.
So how does it process information?
As liquid flows through the system, the enzymes act as processors, cutting the peptides at specific points. But here's the clever part. Once one enzyme makes a cut, the peptide's shape physically changes, and that alters or blocks the opportunity for other enzymes to act on that same molecule. So they all interact freely, creating this complex, constantly changing chemical network that performs computation.
So it has kind of chemical memory, which lets it recognize patterns.
Precisely. The rates of these reactions are naturally affected by things like temperature, which affects each enzyme differently. The system processes chemical inputs and creates an output of peptide fragments. A machine learning algorithm can then link that specific pattern of fragments to a specific input, like temperature. And because the reactions happen on different timescales, the system naturally has a memory of past signals, so it can distinguish between things like fast and slow light pulses.
The implication here is enormous. It's the promise of linking optical and electrical signals directly into chemical responses.
Right. Allowing computers to function not just as digital brains, but as living, adaptive systems that can interact directly with cellular biology. It's the ultimate convergence of digital and biological.
That potential is staggering. Okay, let's wrap up our scientific tour with a look at some immediate planetary challenges, starting with the very sobering global climate data for 2025.
The Global Carbon Budget Report is a pretty stark warning. Worldwide fossil fuel emissions are set to rise 1.1% in 2025. Reaching a record high of 38.1 billion tons of CO2. Earth has now heated 1.36 degrees Celsius since the pre-industrial era.
Which means the 1.5 degree Paris Agreement target is now, for all intents and purposes, impossible to meet.
It is, without massive immediate intervention. We're now in a phase where we have to focus on minimizing the inevitable overshoot and mitigating the damage.
But there are a few powerful positive signs buried in that gloomy data.
There are. The structural shifts in major economies are promising. China's emissions have been basically flat through the third quarter of 2025. That's buoyed by a phenomenal 46% year-on-year growth in solar power.
Wow.
And India's fossil fuel power generation also saw a 3.3% reduction. So while global emissions are still rising, the rate of growth is slowing down a lot this decade compared to the last. The massive renewable energy build-out is starting to change the fundamental energy mix.
A major and rapidly accelerating factor that's complicating our climate goals is the exploding AI industry and its tremendous carbon footprint.
The forecast is it's pretty stark. The U.S. AI server build-out alone is projected to need up to 1.125 billion additional cubic meters of water a year and emit up to 44 million tons of CO2 annually by 2030.
Which means the AI industry is currently on a path that is highly unlikely to meet net zero targets.
Very unlikely.
So what are the main mitigation strategies the sources recommend to control this?
It really comes down to location, decarbonization, and efficiency. As one researcher put it, location, location, location. Placing data centers in Midwestern states where there's more water and the grid has more renewables is crucial. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, deep decarbonization of the energy supply and improving cooling efficiency. Moving from air cooling to liquid immersion, that could cut the industry's emissions by 73% and its water use by 86%.
Next, let's look at a complex oceanic phenomenon, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOs. This is the massive system of currents that acts like a global conveyor belt, carrying heat and keeping Europe relatively warm.
And it's being slowed down by meltwater from Greenland. The AMC works because warm, salty water goes north, cools, gets dense, and sinks in the North Atlantic, which drives the whole current. The fear is that the huge influx of fresh, light meltwater from Greenland stops that sinking process.
Which could lead to a total collapse of the AMC, causing catastrophic cold snaps in northern Europe and major global weather shifts.
Right. But new simulations suggest that meltwater from West Antarctica could, surprisingly, play a protective role. The model found this hidden, complex interaction. If a centuries-long pulse of meltwater from West Antarctica arrives about 1,000 years before the peak of Greenland's melting, because of timing differences, it could prevent the AMOC's total collapse. The circulation would still decline by 60%, but that Antarctic pulse acts as a dampener, speeding up the AMOC's eventual revival over 3,000 years, rather than letting it enter a total irreversible collapse.
That complexity underscores how climate change can trigger geological hazards we rarely consider. And we have the first clear evidence of a drying lake causing more seismic activity and volcanism, based on the history of Lake Turkana in Kenya.
Lake Turkana sits in the Great Rift Valley, where the African continental plate is literally splitting apart. Between 4,000 and 6,000 years ago, East Africa had a massive drought, and the lake's water level dropped by a staggering 100 to 150 meters.
And losing that enormous mass of water had a profound effect on the geology underneath.
Correct. Less water mass meant way less pressure on the Rift Valley lake bed. This unclamping of the geological zone caused fault slippage to increase dramatically. The computer models also suggested that the reduced load allowed more magma to flow up from the mantle.
It's like releasing the pressure on a champagne bottle.
Exactly. Decreasing the weight makes magma more likely to rise and erupt.
Which means seismic hazard assessments worldwide now have to consider climate-induced water level changes, a major new factor for risk modeling.
But another environmental challenge, this one driven by consumer choice, is the proliferation of massive vehicles. SUVs accounted for 63% of new car sales in the UK last year.
And Anthony Laverty highlights three major health harms from this trend, beyond just carbon emissions.
First is road danger. SUVs are taller and blunter. The stats show an adult is 44% more likely to die if they're struck by an SUV compared to a normal car. Second is pollution. Heavier SUVs produce substantially more fine particle pollution from the friction of tires and brakes, and that's a problem that persists even with electric SUVs. And third is physical health. This trend of car spreading, with cars getting wider and taller, just takes up more street space, which actively discourages walking and cycling.
And policy solutions are starting to emerge to counter this.
Yeah, cities like Cardiff and Paris are implementing things like charging owners of larger, heavier vehicles more for parking permits, trying to curb the trend and reclaim the streets.
We can end this section on a note of technological rescue, a highly efficient method for electrostatic defrosting.
This is an ingenious method. It uses a high-voltage copper electrode suspended above a surface, like a car window. It works because frost naturally gets a static charge as it forms. So by applying an opposite charge with the electrode, static electricity literally forces the ice crystals right off the surface.
And the efficiency is what makes it a game changer.
It's remarkably efficient. It removed 50 to 75% of the frost using less than half the energy of direct heat defrosting. The applications are huge, especially in aviation. You could use an electric wand instead of hundreds of liters of expensive polluting antifreeze.
Finally, let's turn to a chronicle of the near future, addressing the growing crisis of information pollution, the AI slop.
By the mid-2020s, the world was just saturated with this low-quality, asinine, brain-sapping content, AI images, clickbait, synthetic video. It began to really degrade public discourse and mental well-being. And the solution, ironically, required using the very tech that caused the problem.
The sources envisioned the invention of dumb glasses, or X-ray specs, by 2028.
These used advanced custom AI embedded in smart glasses, and their only function was to detect and remove all AI-generated content images, banners, synthesized speech from the wearer's augmented reality view. It created an entirely unaugmented reality, allowing people to genuinely detox from the digital noise.
And the online world reacted by creating a network dedicated to guaranteed authenticity.
Yes, this created a third network, the very web, or transparent web. It used unfakeable systems, kind of like blockchain, to guarantee the human provenance of content. Trusted sources like high-quality journalism, human-created art, and Wikipedia, which moved there in 2029, they all migrated to this network to distinguish themselves from the digital sludge.
And the trade-off for users was pretty clear.
Users got authenticity, human connection, freedom from algorithmic profiling. They could trust what they saw. What they lost was the curation and personalization that the algorithms have provided. But, you know, few mourn the loss of the surveillance economy built on their data.
That brings us to the end of our deep dive. We have redefined fat as a dynamic organ, found forbidden quasicrystals in nature's chaos, established the viral link between EBV and lupus, and discovered that ancient art was as much about sonic ritual as visual display.
These insights really do force us to reframe our reality at every level, from the quantum to the cosmic. But let's leave you with one final thought, and it comes from that AI slot prediction and the invention of the dumb glasses filter.
The idea of using advanced AI to filter out all other AI to find authentic human connection. It's compelling. It's like a technological shield against disinformation.
But it raises a profound and very immediate question. If technology has to be used constantly to define what authenticity even is, how long will it take for the next generation of AI slop to learn how to fool the filter? We're relying on technology to vet reality, but what happens when the technology itself becomes indistinguishable from the truth it's supposed to protect? So we have to consider what methods you use in your own life, independent of any filter, to ensure the knowledge and the connections you gain are truly human verified, transparent, and trustworthy.
A vital challenge for the years ahead. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
We appreciate you tuning in.